All right. Well, we're still working off of handout 7 today, so you have that from last time. I think everybody here probably has it. Review here for a couple minutes on what we covered last time, because it's kind of important to the sequence of events today. Okay, from your outline, we're in the period of Seleucid rule, as you might remember from last time. So we're in the last 30 years before the Maccabean revolt. And last time we got down on, if you look at your family tree on the other handout, which is figure 4, if you look at figure 4, we've switched over to the right-hand side, which is the Seleucid dynasty, and we're down to Antiochus IV, which is about halfway down there on your sheet. And that's where we got to last time. Antiochus IV brought a change in policy, if you remember, to the Jews at the time. Before, there had been Hellenization going on, but it had been fairly peaceful. And he now brought more of an active policy of Hellenization, forcing Hellenization. And last time we went through some of the factors involved in the section here, I think on your outline it's called the Antiochian persecution or background. Yeah, down in number 6 on your handout. And we began talking about the sequence of events that happened here. So I'll just quickly review the sequence of events that led up to the persecutions. And remember, this is one sort of reconstruction of what happened. The sources here are a little bit unclear and somewhat contradictory in some cases. And so last time I talked a lot about the different ways people approach that, focusing on one or other catalysts of the events here, but really it's probably a lot of different things that led into this. So it's a sort of a complex sequence that led up to here. But I'm going to be presenting one reconstruction here, one sequence of the events. And so what we talked about last time was that the high priest, Onias III, now remember Onias III, that we also covered this last week, was the last of the Zadokite priestly line. So that's an important thing to remember. He was the high priest at the time, and he was replaced by his brother, Joshua, who's usually known as Jason in the literature. That would be his Greek name. If you remember, Jason basically bribed his way into the priesthood with Antiochus IV by offering to Hellenize, you know, I'll help you with your policy of Hellenization here. And he paid him money, and Antiochus said, sure, you're the new high priest. And we talked before about how Josephus tells us that Jason built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, which was, of course, a great temptation particularly to the Jewish youth at the time. Well, 3 years later, a rival by the name of Menelaus offered more money. So if the priesthood is up for sale, then it goes to the highest bidder. And Menelaus came with more money and said, you know, make me the high priest. And that is what happened. So Jason was deposed and sort of went into hiding in exile. One key difference there is Menelaus at this point now probably was not even from the Levitical line. He was most likely from the tribe of Benjamin, piecing a couple passages together from 2 Maccabees. So this is a major departure now from the Zadokite line of the priesthood. We've got basically a non-Levite in the priesthood. He also subsequently had Onias III, who was the legitimate high priest, murdered after that. So this kind of happened in a couple different stages now. Antiochus had a military campaign in Egypt. And while he was in Egypt, there was a rumor that he had met his end. And so Jason, hearing that, came with a whole group of, you know, basically an army, and came into Jerusalem and took over again. He attacked Jerusalem. He forced Menelaus to take refuge in the citadel. There's a lot of different references to sort of a fortress in Jerusalem that pretty much goes from now all the way through the Maccabean period. And basically what it was a fortress that was built right next to the Temple Mount. So if you're familiar with the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, you know, the one that's there now isn't the one that was there then. It's built on top of it. But the Temple Mount is a high area that can be fortified, and it was fortified with strong walls and defenses. It was almost like a city in a city that could be defended. And they built a citadel next to it. It goes by different names, but there was a fortress next to it that was more of a military installation that became important. So people often took refuge in that. It's kind of like a big tower in the middle of a town where everyone goes. Once the walls are breached, everybody goes into the tower fortress. So we'll refer to that a few times. But so anyways, Menelaus took refuge in there, and Jason was not able to get him out of it. And his attempt was ultimately unsuccessful, and he was forced to withdraw. Because on hearing the report of what was happening in Jerusalem now, Antiochus came back to Jerusalem to restore order. And this was the first event where he intervened militarily in Jerusalem. And we read a couple passages on this. This is Daniel chapter 11, has a prophecy regarding this. And it's recorded in historical form in Maccabees. Both 1st and 2nd Maccabees actually cover this. And we read both of those last week. I'm going to read the 1st Maccabees section again because we're going to pick up in this passage going forward. So just so you have the continuity, I'll read this account from 1st Maccabees. It's found in chapter 1, beginning in verse 16. And I'm going to be reading up through 28. So once he was firmly established on his throne, Antiochus determined to become king of Egypt and so rule both kingdoms. He invaded Egypt with a powerful force of chariots, elephants, and cavalry, together with a great fleet. When battle was joined, King Ptolemy was routed with heavy loss and took flight. The fortified towns in Egypt were captured and the land pillaged. On his return from the conquest of Egypt, Antiochus marched up with a strong force against Israel and Jerusalem. This would correspond to the coming to Jerusalem now because of the unrest that Jason and Menelaus had been causing in Jerusalem. In his arrogance, he entered the temple and carried off the gold altar, the lampstand with all of its fittings, the table of the bread of the presence, the libation cups and bowls and gold censers, the curtain and the garlands. He stripped the gold plating from the front of the temple, seized the silver and gold, the precious vessels, and whatever secret treasures he found, and carried them all away when he left for his own country. He had caused much bloodshed, and he boasted arrogantly of what he had done. And then there's a poetic section here that laments what happened. Great was the mourning throughout Israel, deep the groans of rulers and elders. Girls and young men languished. The beauty of our women was disfigured. Every bridegroom took up the lament. Every bride sat mourning in her bridal chamber. The land trembled for its inhabitants, and all the house of Jacob was wrapped in shame. So that's the historical description of basically what I just gave in outline form. You notice that Antiochus entered the temple at this point in time, and we're told that he was aided in entering the temple by Menelaus, which wouldn't be surprising at that point. He was allied with him. Okay, now this brings us to the second big event that happens, which is another Egyptian battle. And for this one, I'm going to read from Daniel chapter 11 here at this point. Now remember, the things that I'm reading from Maccabees are historical. They were written after the events occurred. There's just a couple verses here that in Daniel that refer to this. So Daniel chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. And he shall return, this is referring to the king of the north, which would be Antiochus the fourth. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the appointed time he shall return and come forth into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. So that's a very brief prophetic word about what was actually going to happen here. So that's what we're going to talk about now. So what happened here is that, just as we read here, he shall return and come again into the south. So at a later time, probably 2 years later, Ptolemy VI, who was the new ruler in Egypt, rebelled against Antiochus's authority. And so Antiochus came down again with his army into Egypt to make war against Ptolemy VI. Except this time, there was a difference. This time, you remember what we were talking about last week, that there is a rising power in the world. And who is that power? Rome. Good. Well, Rome had been asserting its power into Asia Minor and was beginning to take an interest in the Mediterranean area there, in particularly in Egypt. And so Rome had made connections with the Ptolemies at this point in time in Egypt. So this is a great story. So the Roman general actually was in Egypt at this time when Antiochus was there, and they actually met. This is a great story. I love this story. The Roman general, his name sounds like a great Roman general, Gaius Pompilius Lianus. Well, he came up against Antiochus face to face and told him to relinquish, in the name of the Roman Senate, to relinquish all of his claims to Egypt. Now, Antiochus, being the great politician that he is, said, "I'll think about it. Give me some time to think about it. I will take that under consideration." The Roman general then took out his sword, drew a circle in the dirt around Antiochus, and said, "Decide before you step out of the circle." So I'll give you time as long as you do it before you step out of the circle. Well, Antiochus was forced to comply, is the long and the short of it. And he left Egypt sullenly, sort of in a rage, having, been forced to eat humble pie. And he left Egypt and withdrew. And under the reconstruction I'm giving you here, this is the occasion when he really vented his fury on Jerusalem. This is in 168 BC. After being forced to withdraw, he returned to Jerusalem, and this was the real scene of the big persecution. And so here we pick up where we left off in Daniel, reading the next couple verses. So remember what it said here previously in Daniel. He'll go down into the south, but it will not be this time as before, for ships of Kittim shall come against him. The ships of Kittim is sort of the western peoples, which it's most people interpret as the Roman influence there. So in verse 31, we pick up here in Daniel. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. So there's an important phrase in here that you may have picked up on. The abomination that makes desolate. In other translations, it's the abomination of desolation. That may ring a bell with you. The abomination of desolation. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So now we can read the historical, that's the prophetic word, and then let's read the historical account, again, picking up from 1 Maccabees. I'll read a section here about what happened. This is a fairly lengthy section, actually. 2 years later, the king sent a governor to put the towns of Judea under tribute. When he arrived at Jerusalem with a powerful force, his language, though friendly, was full of guile. For once he had gained the city's confidence, he launched a sudden and savage attack. Many of the Israelites were killed, and their city was sacked and set ablaze. On every side, the houses and city walls were demolished. The women and children were captured, and the livestock seized. The city of David was turned into a citadel, enclosed by a high, stout wall with strong towers, and garrisoned by impious foreigners and renegades. Having made themselves secure, they laid up a store of arms and provisions and brought in the plunder they had collected from Jerusalem. They lurked there, a snare and threat to the temple and a perpetual menace to Israel. They shed innocent blood all round the temple. They defiled the holy place. For fear of them, the inhabitants of Jerusalem fled. The city became the abode of aliens, an alien herself to her offspring. Her children forsook her. Her temple lay desolate as a wilderness. Her festivals were turned to mourning, her Sabbaths to a reproach, her honor to contempt. Her present dishonor was equaled only by her past renown, and her pride was turned to mourning. The king issued an edict throughout his empire. His subjects were all to become one people and abandon their own customs. Everywhere the nations complied with the royal command, and many in Israel willingly adopted the foreign cult, sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. The king sent agents to Jerusalem and the towns of Judea with written orders that ways and customs foreign to the country should be introduced. Whole offerings, sacrifices, and drink offerings were forbidden in the temple. Sabbaths and feast days were to be profaned, the temple and its ministers defiled. Pagan altars, idols, and sacred precincts were to be established, swine and other unclean beasts to be offered in sacrifice. The Jews were to leave their sons uncircumcised. They had to make themselves in every way abominable, unclean, and profane, and so forget the law and change all their statutes. The penalty for disobeying the royal command was death. Such were the terms of the edict issued by the king throughout his realm. He appointed superintendents over all the people and instructed the towns of Judea to offer sacrifice, town by town. Those of the people who were ready to betray the law all thronged to their side in large numbers. Their wicked conduct throughout the land drove Israel into hiding in every possible place of refuge. Now, he's given a date here, which doesn't make any sense because of the way he's reckoning it here. But on the 15th day of the month of Kislev in the year 145, the abomination of desolation was set up on the altar of the Lord. In the towns throughout Judea, pagan altars were built. Incense was offered at the doors of houses and in the streets. Every scroll of the law that was found was torn up and consigned to the flames, and anyone discovered in possession of a book of the covenant or conforming to the law was by sentence of the king condemned to die. Thus, month after month, these wicked men used their power against the Israelites whom they found in their towns. On the 25th day of each month, they offered sacrifices on the pagan altar, which was on top of the altar of whole offering. In accordance with the royal decree, they put to death women who had their children circumcised. Their babies, their families, and those who had performed the circumcisions were hanged by the neck. Yet many in Israel found strength to resist, taking a determined stand against the eating of any unclean food. They welcomed death and died rather than defile themselves and profane the holy covenant. Israel lay under a reign of terror. So that really is a description of what's called the Antiochian persecution. There was a tax collector who was sent to Jerusalem by Antiochus by the name of Apollonius, who's referred to here in this passage as a governor. And he was taken into the temple again by the high priest Menelaus, looting it and desecrating it. And most scholars believe that what happened at this point was they erected a statue of Zeus in the temple, which is likely the abomination that causes desolation that's spoken of in Daniel in several places. Actually, I read one of them. And you may recall that Jesus uses that term also in Matthew chapter 24 when he's giving the warning against the persecution that's to come. You remember he says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by the prophet Daniel set up in the temple. So this prophecy in Daniel about the abomination of desolation likely has multiple fulfillments. So most scholars, I believe, think that one fulfillment was the setting up of the statue of Zeus at this particular time. But because Jesus is using it to refer yet to something that hasn't occurred, it's likely that's a future reference. And then how exactly that plays out is open to interpretation. Some believe that it was, again, partially fulfilled when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. There are also hints in the New Testament and in Revelation that that may be wrapped up in a person of the Antichrist figure at the end of days. you know, you can read your study Bibles and in commentaries on Matthew 24 and how Jesus is using that term. But the reference is original to the book of Daniel, and then it's interpreted often as happening here at this point in time when they set up the statue of Zeus. You can hear from here that many Jews were massacred, many others were carried into exile. The city walls were destroyed to make it defenseless. And you heard in here how they built the tower and garrisoned it with foreign troops. That's the tower I was referring to earlier. They outlawed Judaism at this point in time and compelled the worship of pagan gods upon the pain of death. And you heard that the scriptures were burned, the Jewish books and the scriptures were burned, and then women who disobeyed the command to not circumcise their children, when they were caught, they were killed along with the child that had been circumcised. One thing to note here that will become important later is that the Samaritans actively complied with Antiochus's terms. You remember the Samaritans were sort of an odd group of people who had been resettled in Samaria after the 10 tribes went into exile. So that was their lineage. But they held to a lot of Jewish custom. They kind of aligned themselves politically with whoever was in power at the time. They claimed to be Jews often, and there was, you remember we talked about a rival temple that was built in Samaria on Mount Gerizim. So at times when it was convenient for them, they were Jewish, and then when it wasn't, they were quick to repudiate their Judaism and align themselves with the power of the day. In this case, they complied with Antiochus, while many of the pious Jews, of course, were resisting. And this further added to the animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans that we find in the pages of the New Testament. There's other things that led to that as well that we'll talk about later when we get to the New Testament context. But all in all, this was the end of the great persecution. This was how it happened. And these events set the stages then for the Maccabean revolt. Just to sort of wrap up the Seleucid period here, what happened to the Seleucids after this? The next historical thing we're going to talk about is the Maccabean revolt in that period, and then the rise of Rome in Palestine. But what happened to the Seleucid rulers? Well, Antiochus IV continued with his military campaigns. This, by the way, the statue of Zeus was likely set up in the sanctuary in 167 BC. Well, 3 years later, Antiochus IV was on a campaign in Persia when he got news of the Maccabean revolt that was happening in Judea, back in Jerusalem and in Judea. And he contracted some kind of illness and died while he was in Persia. You know, the legend surrounding it is that he had remorse and felt like he was being judged by God for his persecution of the holy people. Whether or not that's true, it's hard to tell. But he did pass from the scene in 164, so 3 years after these events we just read. The Seleucid dynasty continued to exert power in Jerusalem and in Palestine for about another 40-some years. So that would have been through a lot of the period of the Maccabean revolt. They were still fighting against the Seleucid rulers. But the Seleucid rulers began fighting amongst themselves. And, you know, remember we talked about how they had broken into two lines now, where, remember, there was one who was the rightful heir to the throne and then one who wasn't. And Demetrius, you may recall, was involved in that. So they began basically going back and forth battling for the throne and kind of weakened themselves that way, which was favorable for the Maccabeans who were fighting against them at the same period. So they continued, just like the Ptolemies did, if you look on your family tree there, all the way down to the time of Julius Caesar, similar to the Ptolemies. But Merrill Tenney has a great statement here where he says, after the Maccabean revolt, the Seleucid dynasty perished in confusion. And that's probably an apt description of what happened to them. You remember, so last week, again, the conflict. So the assumption of rule by Antiochus IV, who was the brother of Seleucus IV, from your sheet there, that set up this ongoing political battle that pretty much went all the way down to the end, as you can see if you look down the right side of your sheet there. So how do we wrap all this up and summarize it? Remember now, the year that we're up to is around 167 BC. So this is some 300 years into the intertestamental period. If we say the intertestamental period began around the year 450 BC, which is around the time of the book of Malachi being written, we're about 300 years. So all the stuff we've covered so far, the end of the Persian Empire, the rise of Alexander the Great, the division into the four pieces of his empire, the Diadochen period, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, all of that that we just covered is about 300 years, and we're up to the year 167 BC. So you can tell from what we've covered, this was an extremely tumultuous time to be living in Palestine. Changing overlords, the land had really been a continual battleground between the forces of the north and the south, as well as the Persians before that. So in addition to the political and military tumult that was happening at this time, it was also a time of tremendous cultural change and challenges, which ultimately becomes religious temptation to capitulate to the forces of Hellenization that were active, both from without, you know, external, the Greek influence, but also from within, the people who were sympathetic to it and wanted to actively pursue Hellenization. We mentioned before there was important literature written during this period. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Some of the apocryphal books, you know, which we'll get to later when we cover the literature of the period. That was happening during this period of time. And very significantly, the end here, right here that we just covered, marked the end of the long line of the Zadokite priesthood, succession to the priesthood, which would likely have been viewed as a sacrilege to the pious Jews of the day. That dynasty, by the way, if you go all the way back to Zadok, now there was a pause during the exile, but if you go all the way back to Zadok, who lived during the time of David, we're talking about something like 800 years of family succession to the priesthood. So just to show you the significance of that and having that succession end when they exiled and then murdered Onias III. So there had been an internal resistance movement to the Hellenization forces that was growing within Judea at the time. But the Antioch persecution, the stuff that we really just read in detail, was really the straw that broke the camel's back. And that was sort of the last straw where the pious people began to rise up and actually militarily begin to resist the Seleucid rulers at the time. And nowadays that's referred to as the Maccabean Revolt, which is the next historical thing that we'll get to. So before we do that, though, we're going to pause and take a step back and look at two major developments that were happening during this period of time that led up to the Maccabean Revolt. And before we go there, let me open it up for any questions or comments about everything we just covered up to this point. If there's anything at all, or if it's clear. Yes, Dave. Right, so they're in the location of Syria. Now, the Seleucid Empire also extended to the east, further into Persia, and they tried to go to the west towards Rome as well. But it's that whole area there, starting in the west in Asia Minor, going through Assyria and Syria, and then into the east, into Persia, which would be modern-day Iraq and then Iran today. So Syrian, they're often called the Syrians, but in other history books you'll hear them referred to as the Greeks, because all of these people, both the Syrian contingent as well as the Egyptian contingent, were Hellenized, which means they were really under strong Greek influence. So it's sort of a mixture. No, it wasn't a revolt against Rome at all. There's another subsequent revolt against Rome that happened later. That led to the destruction in AD 70. And actually, there's Roman destruction in 63 as well, but that wasn't really a revolt. But we'll get to that. But yeah, the Maccabean Revolt is really a rebellion against the Syrian Seleucid rulers and particularly from the religious aspect of being forced to comply with all the stuff we just read and the persecution. Any other questions or comments? Bill? The question is, for the person who's a real believer in Israel at this time, the pious remnant, if you will, what must they have been thinking? And that's one of the reasons why this is called the silent years, because it was a period of time where God, in his sovereign wisdom, decided he was going to, and it was really a judgment, right? He's withdrawing his revelation and, in some sense, withdrawing his presence. Well, I mean, that really happened in the exile, right, originally. And then you remember Ezekiel's visions of the temple while he was in exile and how God's presence left the temple, right? You remember those visions that Ezekiel had. The sacrilegious things that were going on in the temple, even while they were exiled and after it had been rebuilt. So it must have been a very difficult time for the pious remnant. Now, we know that they're just like in all ages. You mentioned the time of Elijah, and Elijah thought he was the only one. So think about what the political and religious circumstances were at that time. You know, a pagan king is on the throne, and his wife is an idol worshiper. And pretty much everything that Elijah can see, that's the status quo. That's what he's living. And he cries out to God, and God says, no, I have a faithful remnant. And that same type of thing must have been going on here, because we know that there was a faithful remnant during this period. And we don't have any revelation from God to show us that. We know at the end of the Old Testament, we have Malachi, and we have pretty much the last historical thing we have is Nehemiah, and it's an ugly picture at that point in time. But we know Nehemiah was there in Ezra, and he had a contingent of faith of the faithful. And then we don't see anything more until the pages of the New Testament, and we see the same thing. We see Anna, we see Simeon, we see Zechariah, and just as examples that there certainly was still a remnant of God's people who were looking forward to him acting again on their behalf. The thing that we want to keep in mind here, when we're seeing this and we're looking back in history, it's interesting to put yourself in their shoes, and that's kind of what we're trying to do here by going through this history to set the context for the New Testament, you know, because that's where we pick up again with authoritative revelation from God. And I think it helps us to read the New Testament better when we know what had happened leading up to that point. But really, all this is showing that God is going to do something, and that the final kingdom has not yet been set up, but it's preparing for it. And we'll see that when we get to the end of our study here at some point. Hopefully, one of the things we can see is how God was preparing the world and his people for the coming of the Messiah, the Savior of the world, as well as then bringing in all the nations, sending the gospel to all the nations. So a lot of the stuff that we're seeing here, we've touched on some of it already, the Greek influence. We haven't got to the Romans yet, but the Roman influence, all of those things are very significant in the context of when it was the right time for God to send the Messiah, you know, in the fullness of time, and how that prepared the world to be able to get the gospel. The gospel could go to all the nations, and we're beneficiaries of that here in Manchester, New Hampshire, you know, 2,000 years later. The thing that this should remind us of is the fallibility of human institutions and how God, even though it looks hopeless to the Jews at the time, God is working behind the scenes, just like he is in our country, in our world today, to bring his purposes to fulfillment. So, yes, Ginny. The question is, what were the non-high priests? What was their lineage and what were they doing at the time? When I said that the end of the Zadokite line, that's referring to the high priest. Ginny is making the point that the regular priests who were ministering were still from the line of Levi in the Aaronic line, because we know, for instance, in the New Testament, Zechariah was still of the line. So we don't read much about that in this time. All of the historical things focus on the high priesthood. So I think all we can do is assume that the regular priest, not the high priest, the high priest basically became a political appointment And that person was really viewed as the leader of the nation, as a political person. But it's likely that the priests who were ministering day to day in the temple were still from the Aaronic line. And that probably continues all the way to the New Testament. I haven't studied that part of it, so I'm not positive about that, but I believe that that's true. We face a lot of the same challenges and temptations now that they did with the secularization of our world. And my view, this I know this is a little bit up for debate, but my view is that it will get worse. You know, we were talking about Jesus' words there about the abomination of desolation. You know, if that has a future fulfillment when there actually is a severe persecution, that more severe persecution that rises. So, did you have something, John? That's an excellent question. The question is, how do dispensationalists look at this period and tie it together? It's interesting to me that dispensationalists take a lot of this stuff as is going to happen literally in the future. And so I'm not really sure what they do with some of the earlier fulfillments of some of these things. Okay, let's end here. And I'll have a new handout next time, and we're going to look at developments that were happening over this period of time that we just covered that were leading up to the Maccabean period. And specifically, we're going to look at two things. We're going to look at Hellenization. So we've talked a lot about that, but we'll unpack it a little bit more and see what it actually entailed and what it meant. And then we're going to look at what was happening with the priesthood, and particularly in light of Jenny's comment, we'll be talking about the high priesthood. So what was happening with the high priest during this time?